Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Pamela Chaddock, Andre Rodatis, and Marvin Garin. Hi, you guys.
Hello.
Good morning, Paula, Pam, Marvin.
I don't know,
Hi,
did Bob. Chuck say he was going to come later, or... I didn't see Chuck responded to.
Good question.
He said it was going to be. He said it was going to be on.
Okay, good. Well, we'll expect Chuck to be on in a few. Then he'll come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You never know. Sometimes, I mean, it is technically he may be encountering a difficulty or there or so.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, maybe the coffee pot overflowed. No.
Heaven forbid.
It happen. So,
yes.
You guys have a great holiday. You have a great Thanksgiving.
We had a great time. We really enjoyed it. We were up with family and in Spokane. So, I love that holiday. I love Thanksgiving. It's one of my favorite times. You know, even in some senses, I mean, it doesn't have the pointed spiritual significance of Christmas in the culture, you know, with the whole idea of Jesus coming into the world. But it's such a wonderful experience of gratitude, and it's almost always around family and a family meal and cooking together and conviviality. It's one of my favorites.
Me too.
Yeah. It's a great entrance into the Advent season, you know. It's kind of a welcoming to the Advent season.
Yeah.
Really do. It's symbolic too, because, you know, it's the beginning of that time when families draw together, always have, you know, kind of go inside, you know, stay safe and warm, be together, have good food, you know, pack on a few pounds for the long winter, which is not necessary anymore. It's interesting how, you know, our traditional feasting holidays are at that time. It's hardly necessary now, you know, after the it was a big deal after the harvest for people to gather and eat well so that they could survive the lean winter months. But now you just jump in the Jeep and run down to the 7-Eleven. So, you know, but still, it's so in our tradition. And all of the people of the planet have various traditions like that, where they gather and eat the feast.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because it's sort of in the archetypal consciousness of all cultures, because there are two periods of time, the fall and the spring, you know, the gathering of the harvest and the planting of the harvest, which is it's such a powerful symbol, you know, and it's one that the master used, you know, of planting the seeds and the letting the spirit grow the crop in a sense, and then sometimes we get the harvest in our relationships with each other, and so it's such a powerful symbol of harvesting, you know.
Yeah, the circularity of it, you know, the birth and death and. Yeah, the whole picture, in a way.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you, Marvin. I love it. And it's a time to be grateful for all of the good blessings. And it's interesting how anybody who comes, you know, no religious group in America has a problem with Thanksgiving. We all love it, you know. There's no issue around it. Everybody agrees it's a wonderful holiday.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who's in Germany, and I asked her, she's doing her doctorate, someone I know in the interfaith movement, she's a real wonderful person. She's doing her doctorate in interfaith spirituality and theology, really interesting gal. And so I asked her, you know, are you guys celebrating Thanksgiving out there? And she said, and she's American. And she said, no, they don't do that here. And it's interesting, you know, I hadn't realized, but the tradition of the Thanksgiving holiday grew up right around in the aftermath of the Civil War, and it was around giving thanks for the unity and the attempt to heal the nation after that huge trauma, and also giving thanks for the victory you know, the equality of all humankind and the preservation of the union of the country, which was, it was such an existential crisis, you know, and so it's like, it has additional layers of meaning associated with it. It's all kinds of stuff. It's really an interesting holiday.
I always thought it went back, you know, what they tell you when you're a kid, when the pilgrims were saved by the Native Americans and the So maybe it does have some roots going all the way back to the early Americans. I don't know. That's what I was always told as a kid, you know.
Well, you know, we do an interfaith Thanksgiving service, and that's largely my bailiwick here in southern Nevada. We have this interfaith council, and we always started off, for the last several years, we started off with a recognition that for the Native American people, Thanksgiving is a day of tremendous mourning, actually, and recollection of trauma. It's almost like they relate to that holiday, like the Holocaust, which is really, it's bizarre, because it means something so different for them. It means the beginning the end of their nation, in a sense. So we always recognize that and repent and set that as the stage for giving thanks and ask for spiritual unity. And we have some Native American participants in our board, so it's a very powerful part of the ceremony for us.
That's nice.
Yeah,
Columbus Day is like that too, but it's never gained ground, and you know, as a major holiday, but like Thanksgiving has.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, my friends, we are full into paper 7, Relation of the Eternal Son to the Universe. And so far we've done 3 sections, and this week we're on section 4, The Divine Perfection Plans. And, you know, I don't know, last week we did 2 sections. But Section 5 is pretty long, so I don't know if we'll be able to do that. And there's a lot in Section 4. But before we get to our that section, Section 4, Divine Perfection Plans, the Divine Perfection Plans, we wanted to give Marvin some time because Marvin is going to be giving a presentation this afternoon, today, in a few hours. And we wanted to give you a chance, Marvin, to tell everybody what that's going to be and invite them. And we can discuss, too, a little bit if you like.
Yeah. If it's intriguing to y'all, this is something I connect every now and then with Jeannie Vasquez, who's the chair of the UAI Education Committee, and so she coordinates a lot of their kind of major Zoom presentations, but often on a Saturday. And so she got in touch, and we talked about it. And so the UAI is hosting it. It's at 2 p.m. Pacific time is when it begins, 2 to 3:30. So it's for about an hour and a half. And so that's, 3 p.m. Central and 3 p.m. Mountain, 4 p.m. Central, and 5 p.m. Eastern is the start time. And the title of it is Outreach/Evangelism, Audiences, Callings, and Key Questions. Mm-hmm. It's really an interesting topic, and as Andre is familiar, it's something that has been pretty central, that theme of calling and audiences, and how do we understand what God is asking us to do in the way of service around the gospel and sharing the essential truth of what Jesus shared with us, that is life transforming, that changes us, that grounds us and brings us that peace that passes all understanding. How do we do that? How does that urge to reach out and share the gospel truths with our struggling fellows, how does that arise in us, that urge? We're going to be talking about the nature of how God calls us to minister, to teach, to share the life-saving gospel. And we're going to talk about how that calling grows in us, initiates, grows in us, and reaches some degree of maturity, and how it's kind of like an itch that we have to scratch if we really take the spiritual life seriously. If we're serious about our relationship with God. And then there's this passage from Rodin, and it's 165:3, and it's sort of a keynote for what I'm going to present, just to sort of set us off, gets us going. And he says, if something has become a religion in your experience, it is self-evident that you already have become an active evangel of that religion, since you deem the supreme concept of your religion as being worthy of the worship of all mankind, all universe intelligences. If you are not a positive and missionary evangel of your religion, you are self-deceived in that what you call a religion is only a traditional belief or a mere system of intellectual philosophy. So, I mean, the theme there, which we start off with, is, to really do this the way God wants us to do it means you take the spiritual life seriously. It becomes the central driving reality in your life, I think. And part and parcel of that is this urge to share the gifts that you've been given for people who are less fortunate, who haven't benefited from this living relationship we can have with God as a beloved child of God, and all the solace and peace and satisfaction that it brings. And so we start off there. We talk about how the calling to serve, to share the gospel, grows in us. And we're going to have three times where we break out into conversations. I'll share some thoughts. And first one is going to be on the nature of calling and how it grows in us and what we've experienced with it. The second theme will be audiences, And so we look at what is it in our background, in our temperament, our cultural background, how we grew up, et cetera, that equips us and draws us to work especially effectively with certain groups of people and certain individuals within those groups, so that our natural inclinations are to find a ready home for proclamation and evangelism. So we're going to be looking at audiences that we can work with. And then the last theme is around, do we use the text itself? How do we use the Urantia book effectively in our ministry? Do we focus on the central truths? Do we feel called to teach the more sophisticated and advanced concepts of the text, which all of which is valid? There's no limitation on the variations of how we feel called to serve, to share truth. And so we talk about that, and then in the last section we also talk about, well, how do you conceptualize the gospel? How do you understand the essence of what Jesus taught, the essence of what the Urantia book teaches, so we can kind of coordinate, organize our lives around those realities and make them front and center? And also, how do we, what words do we use? What phrases and words, what language do we use to convey that to people who sort of two audiences, one who are familiar with the Urantia book, and frankly, readers of the Urantia book need an understanding of the core gospel almost as much as non-readers, because there's so much in the text and you got to bring it front and center and make it accessible, I think. But the other thing is, how do you use language? What language do you use to convey the essential spiritual truths in this revelation to people who will never read the Urantia book? You know, how do you express it? How do you convey it? So that's the last segment, and each of those segments will be opening up to conversation. So that's
nice.
That's it.
Yeah, very
perfect.
Very good.
Well, you know, you can go to, for our listeners, and I assume this will be, it's a webinar, and I'm assuming it will be recorded so that people can watch it later. Many people won't know about it in time today, but they'll hear about it on when they listen to the archived show. We have a lot of listeners who listen to the archive, and so you can go to https://urantia-association.org. Look under events when you get there, and you'll see this webinar listed there. And I posted it on the board as well. And I'm just so glad.
Jeannie also said that it was going to be on YouTube, so they're going to put it up on YouTube as well. Yeah.
It's an important conversation. You know, we're blessed, Andre and I are totally blessed, and you too, Marvin, you know, I mean, you're a part of this thing that happened in Boulder and Denver back in the early 80s when we all took this upon ourselves and said, this has got to happen. Mm-hmm. We've got to start talking about this thing. And we've got to start telling people about it. The news is too good to keep it to ourselves.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And the culture back then was go slow. Don't talk about it. You won't do it justice. You know, and there was so much fear around that. We can't, how can we possibly begin to talk about this thing and do it justice? But we did it. We found our courage and we went out and we set up a card table at the People's Fair. And we started talking to the public about the Urantia book. And to my knowledge, we were the first group that ever did that. And we learned a lot. We learned a lot over the years. And one of the things that I've seen, one of the mistakes that I've seen us readers make over and over again is we, you know, the Urantia book is so conceptually rich, but all of the concepts are, you know, they're undergirded by other, you know, the book covers these concepts throughout, and so we tend to go down a rabbit hole. We want to tell somebody all of the things that go into making this concept, right? And we get into And we dive into places where, you know, the person that's hearing this narrative goes glassy-eyed.
Glassy-eyed, yes.
Yeah, they haven't a clue what you just said. And so I think our challenge is to boil it down to the essence of what they're trying to convey on that concept. Mm-hmm. And maybe perhaps the most important things, and I always would begin any outreach adventure with, Father, you know, they may or may not ever pick up the Arantia book, but please, let me give them something they can keep.
Mm-hmm.
Conceptually, mm-hmm. you know, and it wouldn't, whether that's about the fear of God or about the spirit that dwells within us, God not being afar off in the skies, the love of God, you know, something they can keep.
Well,
and,
you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead, finish it now.
Well, and that was it. And I just want to say hi to Chuck. Hi, Chuck. You made it. Yay.
Hey.
Glad you're here.
Yeah.
We're all
hey,
here.
Hi, Chuck.
That's nice.
Hi, Chuck.
Yeah.
Welcome.
And
yeah,
just to catch you
yeah.
up, Marvin is telling us about the webinar he's going to be doing this afternoon. So, for Urantia Association International, and it's about you know Urantia book outreach and evangelism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, great. Yeah,
and,
Well, and you know what you were saying, Paula, and I think this is just as relevant for Urantia book readers as it is for people who are not who are just. Spiritual seekers out in the world, right? Jesus, he was really interesting as he did his outreach because he talked with an incredible array of different kinds of people, some of whom were intellectually extremely sophisticated, and he gave them advanced truths, especially in his personal ministry. But even to groups of people, like, you know, he would, when he did the Urmia lectures or he talked to a group of philosophers, he was very sophisticated in what he shared, but what he invariably did, whether it was a sophisticated audience or a simple audience, he always shared some essential truths that were spiritually life-saving, right? They were salvation for the soul, and they went to the heart of what every human being needs. And so the issue of how you conceptualize the core of the gospel is an extremely important issue. How do you communicate it? What words do you use? And I'm going to get into this in the last segment of the webinar. For me, the best way to describe it is a way of life in the family of God, that it's a mm-hmm. set of living spiritual or family relationships, and the primary relationship is this intimate, nurturing, nourishing parent-child relationship that we can have with God, that God is inside mm-hmm. of us, loving us and growing us up as a spiritual child, and that we're not alone. We are loved. Mm. And I think mm-hmm. what most people hunger for, Urantia book readers or not Urantia book readers, I can't tell you the number of UB readers who basically say, you know, this is the core for me, and I can read the whole book, and I can get lost in the abstrusities of the book, you know, talking about the rabbit hole. What's of essence is that God loves me. I can feel that every single day, that ennobling truth that I'm a beloved child mm-hmm. of God mm-hmm. and that we're sisters and brothers together in that family relationship, and that that's an eternal experience that will only grow to cosmic levels. So when you convey that to people, that is nourishing for them on the most fundamental level. And all the rest is important, but it's backdrop for that essential drama of living spiritual family relationships that are unfolding. And so I like to make that, that's the language I use, that this is a profoundly transforming and satisfying and nurturing way of life in spiritual family relationships, you know. Mm. And that seems to speak to people in the interfaith movement. It speaks to spiritual seekers, whether they, you know, are going to read the Urantia book or not. So we're going to talk some about that, you know, this afternoon as well.
Nice. Yeah.
sounds good.
It's important. It's important, the conversation to have, that we do find our courage, because ultimately, I think the Arantia book seems bigger than we can, you know, we're not up to the task. We feel like we're not up to the task. And we get overwhelmed. We don't know where to start. And so, but just having the conversation helps you. And
well,
keep trying.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
looking to Jesus, I think that's always a good idea.
Absolutely.
Good to see how he handled the variation in his listeners, like you were saying, Marvin, even just on his own crew, you know, within his own apostles. You know, he went all the way from the Alpheus twins up to some of the others who are, you know, very intelligent in their attempts to understand what Jesus was saying. But, you know, he was introducing some new concepts. And you know, as we know, it's not a – what did they say? His most original teaching was that Spirit of God lives within you or something like – the kingdom of heaven is within.
Yeah.
Something along those lines.
And amazing to think about that.
Yeah, but he makes it so simple. You know, that's one of the things I admire about Jesus and how he taught, is he was always able to simplify what he was trying to get across so that it could be taken in or understood by any listener, really. I mean, but that if you have a group, then it's harder. But even so, you know, he used simple nature metaphors, he used, you know, parables and all of that. And that gave him an approach into people's minds that they kind of weren't expecting, maybe you could say. You know, that they there's something here. You know, I'm just trying to put myself in the position of someone who's listening to Jesus speak and teach, and how that can enter your heart without necessarily always being fully comprehended by the mind.
Yes.
And that's, I mean, thinking of like the Alpheus twins, he definitely reached their hearts. They reached their hearts. That was like the key thing.
And the key to that is to be open-hearted. You can't reach someone whose heart isn't open. Neither can you reach a mind that isn't open, right? But if someone is open-hearted and open-minded, you can reach them.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Pam.
Well, Jesus is open-hearted. So. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it was a process too, you know. It's like, how long must I bear with you? How many times did he say that?
Right.
So, you know, it's not an immediate, you know, grasp. So, but yeah, it is. We can learn a lot from how he approached and the patience that it took and different ways he used. Yeah, you're right, depending on his audience. And
A
couple of things have really helped me with outreach and from the book. One is that great motto that says, whet the appetites of your associates for truth. And then, you know, because in that is an appetizer is a small little bit, you know, it's not the whole meal. It's just a bit, it's a tidbit, and you get to decide by listening to their, you know, you have a conversation, and you start asking some questions, and you find out who this person is, and then you can give them what, you know, what you perceive. You can whet their appetites with something, because now you know a little bit about them, you know. And the other thing is Jesus telling the apostles, you know, you will become fishers of men. And the same thing, it's the same principle. When you're fishing, you need just a little morsel of what it is the fish likes to eat. Right? You're not using a bait that they don't like or are not interested in, you know. Fish don't care much for donuts, but they love cheese.
Yeah, pick your bait, right?
Yeah, you have to be wise. You have to go about it with a little bit of wisdom and forethought, not just, you know. So that, and so much of that comes just from listening, you know. And the other thing is, you know, Jesus, that great teaching that says, to those he helped the most, he said the least. Mm-hmm. Most people mm-hmm. were just anxious and needed to unburden their souls. And it would start by him asking questions and end by them asking questions. I think that's just invaluable. That's a little midwayer wisdom right there, you know, mm-hmm. about Jesus's technique. And I always appreciate that because I think it's sometimes, you know, I read something that was about active listening and how oftentimes, you know, when you're listening, you're thinking about your response. You're not actually really listening.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think it's so important.
That.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about how Jesus went about teaching, and you see this most, I think, in his personal ministry when he was one-on-one, because he could do it to the max when it was personal, and that was you're right, Paula. He would listen. He would ask questions. He would learn who they were.
Mm-hmm.
And he would love them as he was learning who they were. And then when they asked him something, he could use the very language and concepts that they had shared with him that had been relevant to them to grow and build his sharing of
exactly.
truth. So he, so yes. in a sense, he learned the language of their lives before
absolutely.
He ever taught them something. And then he used that language. So, I mean, I think that's mm-hmm. part of it. The other thing
yeah.
that you were mentioning that often doesn't get, we don't depend upon it enough, is that he is with us now, right? His Spirit of Truth, one of the main functions of the Spirit of Truth is to help us teach. That's what they
right.
say.
Absolutely.
In the moment when we're with someone who's hungry, to basically be listening interiorly for the whisperings of the master and how
right.
he would reach them and touch them and to work in partnership, profound partnership with the Spirit of Truth. So, you know, we're going to get into some of that this afternoon too when we do the webinar.
Nice.
Because
right.
I don't
you
I
know,
think
one
without,
one
without,
of...
without spiritual involvement, I think we're empty glass and tinkling bells. We're not effective without spiritual involvement, I think.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of spiritual involvement, how about the divine perfection plan?
If I could just throw in one thing.
That's my sister talking. Yeah.
Yeah.
We have been speaking from Andre about this.
Rate him in, Pam.
Well,
all right.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Let's
well,
jump in.
Well, Chuck
had one more thought, though,
yeah,
and then
just
we'll...
One last
oh, Chuck always has something.
Yeah, I
come
know.
On.
I always say, well, I got here late. So.
We
yeah,
love
yeah.
your one more thought, Chuck.
Catching up.
Yeah. I mean, this is so charming, the way they describe this little bit about Jesus, where they say that this is in paper 171, where they say he never engaged in the meddlesome probing of the souls of his associates. As he comforted hungry minds and minister to thirsty souls, the recipients of his mercy did not so much feel that they were confessing to him as that they were conferring with him. So I just love that. It's just so charming. Yeah, I can imagine that.
It's a real talent to make people feel safe, you know, to let
yes,
them know they
exactly.
are safe.
Yeah.
And that they're free to open up to you. It's
mm-hmm.
a gift. Of course, Jesus would be the master at that, for sure.
Yeah.
But, thanks.
But again, it shows engagement, just like we've all been talking about. That shows engagement. For a person to
well,
feel
we know.
That way.
Here's
so
a segue for
trust.
You guys.
Yeah.
We know that he is fully engaged in these divine perfection plans, right?
Let's read about that.
Yes, he is.
He's down with that program. He is totally on board with that program.
Without
the
bestowal
the,
plan, there wouldn't have been any Jesus
right.
to confer
the,
with. That's right.
In the beginning.
There you go.
In the beginning.
There you go.
Yeah.
Wow.
Good point.
Wonderful.
Andre. Well, who wants to read section 4?
I'd love to
okay.
jump in.
All right.
Yay.
Yeah, jump right in.
The Divine Perfection Plans. The Eternal Son is in everlasting liaison with the Father in the successful prosecution of the Divine Plan of Progress, the universal plan for the creation, evolution, ascension, and perfection of willed creatures. And in divine faithfulness, the Son is the eternal equal of the Father. The Father and his Son are as one in the formulation and prosecution of this gigantic attainment plan for advancing the material beings of time to the perfection of eternity. This project for the spiritual elevation of the ascendant souls of space is a joint creation of the Father and the Son. And they are, with the cooperation of the Infinite Spirit, engaged in associative execution of their divine purpose. The divine plan of perfection attainment embraces three unique, though marvelously correlated, enterprises of universe adventure, the plan of progressive attainment. This is the Universal Father's plan of evolutionary ascension, a program unreservedly accepted by the Eternal Son when he concurred in the Father's proposal, "Let us make mortal creatures in our own image." This provision for upstepping the creatures of time involves the Father's bestowal of the thought adjusters and the endowing of material creatures with the prerogatives of personality. Two, the bestowal plan. The next universal plan is the great Father revelation enterprise of the Eternal Son and his coordinate sons. This is the proposal of the Eternal Son and consists of his bestowal of the sons of God upon the evolutionary creations, there to personalize and factualize, to incarnate and make real the love of the Father and the mercy of the Son to the creatures of all universes. Inherent in the bestowal plan and as a provisional feature of this ministration of love, the Paradise Sons act as rehabilitators of that which misguided creature will has placed in spiritual jeopardy. Whenever and wherever there occurs a delay in the functioning of the attainment plan, if rebellion, perchance, should mar or complicate this enterprise, then do the emergency provisions of the bestowal plan become active forthwith. The Paradise Sons stand pledged and ready to function as retrievers, to go into the very realms of rebellion and there restore the spiritual status of the spheres. And such a heroic service a coordinate creator son did perform on Urantia in connection with his experiential bestowal career of sovereignty acquirement. Three, the plan of mercy ministry. When the attainment plan and the bestowal plan had been formulated and proclaimed, alone and of himself, the Infinite Spirit projected and put in operation the tremendous and universal enterprise of mercy ministry. This is the service so essential to the practical and effective operation of both the attainment and the bestowal undertakings. And the spiritual personalities of the third source and center all partake of the spirit of mercy ministry, which is so much a part of the nature of the third person of deity. Not only in creation, but also in administration, the Infinite Spirit functions truly and literally as the conjoint executive of the Father and the Son. The Eternal Son is the personal trustee, the divine custodian of the Father's universal plan of creature ascension. Having promulgated the universal mandate, "Be you perfect even as I am perfect," the Father entrusted the execution of this tremendous undertaking to the Eternal Son. And the Eternal Son shares the fostering of this supernal enterprise with his divine coordinate, the Infinite Spirit. Thus do the deities effectively cooperate in the work of creation, control, evolution, revelation, and ministration, and if required, in restoration and rehabilitation.
So, you know, I gotta say, as I'm looking at this, I'm just blown away by how the word that comes to mind, how seminal, theologically, how seminal, how central this section is, what it lays out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, it lays out the whole structure of reality in this universe age, like what we're part of, what we're doing, and how the gods have made all of this for us and for all the created beings. And the three interlocked parts of it, there's so much detail here, but it strikes me as absolutely fundamental information, this section does.
Yes.
You know, it's what we're part of and what
it's
the gods have made.
It's foundational, yes.
Yeah, it's foundational. I mean, the whole idea that the universe, that our ascension is so central to the universe plan of the deities, that this is kind of what they set in motion that's happening, and the bestowal plan is so crucial in the execution of that, the successful execution of that, and that the mercy ministry of the Spirit and all of the vast hosts of our angelic sisters at every level are just they're what's the word, you know, when a vast army goes into motion, you know, it's just like they're I'm missing a word, but they're given their mandate to go out and minister broadly to the entirety of both the two, the ascension plan and the bestowal plan. They're basically told, you go out and make this happen, help make this happen. And they are our partners in the accomplishment of everything that we do, you know. So I mean, it's just, it's so profound that they're sharing
yes.
this.
Yes. There to personalize and factualize, to incarnate and make real the love of the Father and the mercy of the Son. It's like, it's just in our, you know, in our very being. Yeah.
Such a profound misunderstanding we have about these things. And this is, you know, the beauty of this revelation, that in one section, as you said, Marvin, it can lay this out where you go, oh, of course, you know, we're all engaged in progressive attainment. I mean, you can't live on this planet for 70 years and not know that.
Right.
I mean, that's so basic. What have you learned this year that you didn't know last year? You know, what do you know today that you didn't know yesterday? You know, have you gotten better at the art of living? You know, we're all striving for that. That's so intrinsic in us. We just want that. We want that for ourselves. We want that for our children, our progeny. We want progress. We want life to be better today than it was yesterday, and better tomorrow than it will be today. And that's just so built into us as, you know, evolutionary creatures. But then this, and they say, okay, so we've got that. Now we're going to talk about how we're going to help you get there. And, you know, I got to say part two, just, you know, that second or that fifth paragraph, number two, the bestowal plan, just tugs at my heart being from this planet, you know, because I think of Jesus, the Good Shepherd, right? In every way. He is the Good Shepherd, and he came out. You know, we knew the book tells us he was going to do this bestowal somewhere, but we needed him so much, and it provided him such an effort to maximize this bestowal, not only for us, but for the whole universe. And he saves us for God. He's the retriever. I love that word.
Yes, the retriever.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting, Paula, that it's an emergency function, though. I mean, it's part of the bestowal plan. But what's so interesting is that it's rare. The majority of the time, the bestowal sons come down and engage in their ministry, which is crucial for every world that a bestowal son come, right? But in most situations, they don't come to rebellion spheres. They come to normally progressing spheres, but they perform a crucial function in promoting and enabling, allowing the ascension plan to unfold well. And in those rare situations, which we were unfortunate enough to be in, they come to these rebellion-torn worlds and gather in the lost sheep who have wandered far afield, you know. Mm. And so it's such a rich picture. But the other thing that struck me that I haven't really focused on that much before is it's the ascension plan that is the primary one of these plans that is unfolding. And maybe I may be alone in this. You guys may disagree. The bestowal plan and the mercy ministry plan are both in support of the primary purpose of what's going on in this universe age, which is the unfolding of the Supreme. All of it is part of the unfolding of the Supreme. But the front and center driving experience is our perfecting and attention as mortal beings. And so what it says to us is you are, in a sense, the most important thing going on in the cosmos. At this stage of things, the endowing of you as animal beings, primitive animal beings, with the prerogatives of personality, free will, choice, consciousness, the ability to choose God's will and embrace the goal of perfection of God and ascend through an eternal career of progression. That's the main drama that's unfolding on the stage of existence. And the bestowal plan and the mercy ministry plan are there to aid us in accomplishing that drama. That's incredibly powerful to say, you guys are it. This is why we're doing all this stuff. Mm-hmm. That's so affirming, so affirming, you know, to us as to who we are to God as beloved children, you know. We're really important. It's what the whole thing's about, in a sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
The formulation and prosecution of this gigantic attainment plan for advancing the material beings of time to the perfection of eternity. Right there, second paragraph.
That's it.
Yeah. That's the why of it all.
Pretty stunning.
There's an interesting correlation that I hadn't noticed before that comes up out of the second paragraph that you were just pointing us to. A minute ago, Pam, in that first sentence, they say the next universal plan is the great father revelation enterprise of the eternal son and his coordinate sons. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that that's hyphenated. It's father hyphen revelation, the great father revelation enterprise. And, you know, I can see that. I mean, we're experiencing that in our own way.
Without a doubt.
But what I noticed about that I hadn't noticed before, was how it sort of correlates with something that Jesus said when he's talking about being born again, being born of the Spirit. You know, I'm sure we all remember this, but where he says, it remains eternally true. Behold, I stand at the doors of men's hearts and knock, and if any man will open to me, I will come in and sup with him. And we'll feed him with the bread of life, and we shall be one in spirit and purpose. But then the next thing he says, I think, is really intriguing. And he says, and so shall we ever be brethren in the long and fruitful service of the search for the paradise Father.
Mm.
And that's like there's a collaborative enterprise going on here. You know, we shall ever be brethren in the long and fruitful search. Long and fruitful service of the search for the Paradise Father. So doesn't that sound like it relates somehow to the great Father Revelation Enterprise?
Oh, yes. And we're all being enlisted in it.
Yeah, Yeah.
Well, it also relates to the fact that, you know, Jesus is a creator son. The creator sons of Michael is a creator son. We're all of the order of sons, and the eternal son is the firstborn. But mm-hmm. but the eternal son is a created being like us, in that sense, and mm-hmm. so is Jesus, a created
yes.
being,
yes.
and a creator.
Mm-hmm.
So we are brethren in the sense that we're all of the order of sons of God, which is really,
right.
really confirming of what you're saying, Chuck.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. Too.
That in itself is foundational right there.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to, you know, take us off course or anything, but I just have to point out, and Andre, forgive me, brother, that the bestowal plan was one of the things that Lucifer attacked in his manifesto. And he came at it pretty hard. And here's a cross-reference, and I don't know, we don't necessarily have to talk about it, although they are mentioning rebellion, and we know, you know, if you read the Arantra book, you know we're a planet in rebellion. And it's the source of all of the agony that we go through down here on this planet, the fact that none of these plans were, you know, carried out the way the Father would have had them be carried out for our ultimate good and benefit. They were derailed and because of rebellion against this very plan. This is from paper 53, paper 53, section 3, paragraph 6. And this is one of the points that Lucifer attacked in his manifesto that he launched his rebellion with. The attack upon the universal plan of ascendant mortal training. Lucifer maintained that far too much time and energy were expended upon the scheme of so thoroughly training ascending mortals in the principles of universe administration, principles which he alleged were unethical and unsound. He protested against the age-long program of preparing the mortals of space for some unknown destiny and pointed to the presence of the Finaliter Corps on Gerasim as proof that these mortals had spent ages of preparation for some destiny of pure fiction. With derision, he pointed out that the Finaliters had encountered a destiny no more glorious than to be returned to the humble spheres similar to those of their origin. He intimated that they had been debauched by overmuch discipline and prolonged training, and that they were in reality traitors to their mortal fellows, since they were now cooperating with the scheme of enslaving all creation to the fictions of a mythical eternal destiny for ascending mortals. He advocated that ascenders should enjoy the liberty of individual self-determination. He challenged and condemned the entire plan of mortal ascension as sponsored by the Paradise Sons of God and supported by the Infinite Spirit. That manifesto is so compelling. You know, I don't know if you guys experienced that when you first read that, but I thought, wow. It sounds like some of my friends I have, hippie friends.
I heard this before. It sounds familiar somehow.
But you know, just imagine, Paula, you know, what if that, what Lucifer was saying, what if it were that were the reality? I mean, think about the implication for us. What that would be saying is, your guys' destiny is here in this system. That's it. We want
right.
You're just going to stick around here and plod along for eternity, right here. You have nowhere to go. There's no grand goal of perfection attainment. You just are who you are and just accept it. What a tragic deception that is. Or what is
yeah.
that? Look what that deprives us of. It deprives us of this primary gift that the gods set out to give us in making us and all of reality. It says none of that is true. There's nothing to attain.
Right.
You know, what a dull existence that would be. I mean, it's like, that's it's just so overwhelming to think of what he was depriving us of you know.
Well,
and it just makes no sense whatsoever.
And from his point
of
view, how could he know what it felt like to be an evolving mortal on a planet like this? He wouldn't know a thing about that. But go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, well, I was going to say there's something interesting about that, what you're both saying there, because Lucifer, as you recall, of course, denied the existence of the Universal Father. You know, he admitted that was a scheme created by the Creator Sons to rule in his name, but he didn't actually exist, the Father, that is. So at the same time, we have Jesus telling us that the search for the Father is a service. You know, that little bit I read a minute ago, where they say that we'll ever be brethren in the long and fruitful service of the search for the Paradise Father. So that's a completely different attitude. It's like the Father is something, someone, something, someone to be discovered. And that discovery in and of itself is a service. And I just think that's so intriguing in terms of how that relates to what Lucifer was saying. like you're saying, Paul, he just pulls the rug out from everything of value in our experience.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea that even the way Jesus put that, he's still searching for the Father as well, even though he's a Creator Son. You know, we'll be brethren in the long and fruitful service of the search for the Paradise Father. So there's an
eternal search,
right. So that's a very different attitude, obviously, because we don't know all about the Father. We only know what we know, which is pretty little so far. But the idea that the search for the Father is a service is just like, wow, that completely reframes the question, I think, in a really interesting way. It's long and fruitful. It's a fruitful thing. Right?
Yeah, something, it is measurable. You can see it working in your own life. You can see it working in the lives of others.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even to the meager degree that we've experienced it here so far, right? I mean, we're just down here at the bottom. And look at what we've experienced. And for me, on a feeling level, if there were no God and there were no progression, no eternal life of progression and service and ever-increasing relationships with more and more celestial brothers and sisters in this incredible experience of spiritual family, loving and God and loving each other, if it was all just here and no God, how pointless and empty that feels to me. I mean, it's devastating to think that that's all there is. And that's what he was saying, you know?
Yeah.
That's what he was saying is that's all there is. So, you know, just face up and accept it. Just do your thing here. What an empty cosmos, you know?
Don't be a fool. Don't be duped.
And isn't that
amazing how even angels are susceptible to that sophistry? What is it about us lower beings that makes us so afraid of being the fool, you know, of being lied to or fooled or tricked or enslaved or, you know, taken advantage of?
She's promising freedom and liberty. You know, he's the friend of men and angels. You know, he's going to set us free.
Yeah,
I think that's where it gets.
John dropped this
seductive,
too.
Seductive,
on the
seductive.
Board. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Very seductive.
Yeah, and so John brought that up on the board.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
As a liberty and freedom is the current rallying cry for the moneyed interests around the globe. The oligarchy wants liberty to accumulate as much as possible, and they want freedom to generate as much income without regulation or taxes. I mean, this is getting into a political realm, but this is part of the fallout of that whole belief system of Lucifer's. And it just galls me in this paper 53 where the principles, he's saying principles which he alleged were unethical and unsound. I mean, unethical. I mean, talk about projection.
Yeah, right.
Major unethical what he was doing, and yet accusing the father's plan as being an unethical plan.
It's seductive, is what it is. It's very seductive.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's seductive. Gary made the point on the board, he was saying he was all we need. He could set us free. I'm going to create a doubt in your mind about who you are and what's going on because you don't know any better. I'm going to create a big doubt in your mind and make you feel like you're being taken advantage of, you're being enslaved, you're being duped, and then I'm going to swoop in and save you. I'm the great savior. I'm the one that's going to make it all better. I'm the friend of men and angels, right? Not the loving beings of the universe who have served and ruled from time immemorial. Not them. No. Me.
Yeah, right.
Let me ask you guys, if your reaction is the same as mine, and again, I'll say, we have tasted of this relationship with God, right? I mean, we've experienced it. We have felt that love. We've experienced what it's like to move through life in partnership with the indwelling spirit who loves us and who we love, who we worship, and the fruits of that in our lives. And so let me ask, for me, if what Lucifer was offering was, no, none of that is real. It's just you and your own power and what you can accumulate and mucking around here in this local part of the universe. Every man for himself. It's just exactly the stuff that they described on the board of the accumulation of riches, the accumulation of power, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. My reaction to that is, compared to what I've got with God so far, it's like totally dull. It's totally unattractive to me. Why would I want that?
Tinkling
symbols. It's just like, why would I choose that?
Right.
It's so empty and barren. Yeah, there's no love in it,
Right.
There's no purpose or value in it. It's just selfish aggrandizement at every turn. It's just.
Yes.
Well, it's totally dead end.
Yeah, it's a dead end.
Because there's also a pattern, though, that I think we can see that will help us understand when we're being subjected to sophistries or whatever you want to call it. Even now, today, it's just like you're saying, you can still see this playing out, unfortunately. So the pattern is this. What Lucifer was doing was accusing Michael of usurping sovereignty through creating the myth of the universal father, right? He was accusing Michael of usurping sovereignty. But then if you look at the situation, that's exactly what Lucifer was doing. He was the one who was trying to usurp sovereignty, not Michael.
Yes.
So this pattern of accusing your enemy of what you're actually doing yourself is a pervasive pattern.
It is a pervasive pattern. Yeah, it's what happens when you live in the shadow. When you live in the shadow, that's all you see. You don't see the whole picture.
But that pattern of accusing your enemy of what you're actually doing yourself.
Exactly. And that's all you see. Because you don't have
the
light. You are rejecting
the
light.
You see it all the time.
And you have to be aware of it. You really do. You have to really evaluate that when someone's making some bold proclamation about what they are doing.
Right.
I was like,
chances are it's what they're doing.
Look over there. Look over there.
It's a great way to divert attention.
Yes, exactly. Sleight of hand. But I want to share what Bob on the board said. He said, when reading the Lucifer's manifesto, it is easy for me to see the untruth, the falseness, but I think that clarity is only because I know the truth from Jesus that I have learned and experienced after reading the Urantia papers. And it's true. Truth is a mighty lens that you can look at these sophistries through. And just like, you can reason with yourself. Does this make sense? You know, does this stand up? Does this stand up to the light of truth? Does it stand up to the light of beauty and the light of goodness? You know, what have I experienced in my life that would lead me to think this is right or true? And, you know, I think we really have to evaluate any bold proclamations like the Lucifer Manifesto. And I personally think that he launched his orgy of darkness and death based on false loyalty. I think that, you know, he was set up in a role of being caregiver and provider. And when someone is in that role of being the one who is the administrator and the one who gives care and the one who provides, anybody under that person is naturally inclined to be loyal to them. And it would be like your father telling you, you know, don't listen to that man. He's a bad man. He's trying to harm you. And if you love your father, you would say, okay. And it's very hard to be in the position of evaluating the truth of what your father is saying from a point of view of original, you know, personality that has the right to evaluate these things and doesn't have to just take his word for it. Doesn't have to naturally just be loyal to him because he's the one that's been taking care of you. You know, that to me is the crux of the betrayal of trust. The trust is that I'm giving you these young beings to be in charge of, that you don't lead them astray, and that you tell them the truth, and that you, you know, take care of them in the way they need to be taken care of. That was the betrayal of trust. And look, we're still dealing with it. We're still, you know.
Yes.
But,
oh, yes.
Yeah. And had Jesus not come here to retrieve us, which he did do, in that way, he is our Savior. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Oh, yeah.
He is truly a Savior. He saves us all from the folly of sin.
Yes. Yeah. Redemption became very clear to me in the words of this section we've been reading. You know, retrievers and whatnot. Yeah, he definitely is saving us. Rehabilitators and retrievers is redemptive action.
You know, it's interesting. It's something that's interesting to me, though, a little nuance of how that all unfolded. And they just say it briefly, but what they say is that none of the ascenders on Gerasim, who had, obviously they had, most of them, if not all of them, had fused with their thought adjusters. None of them succumbed to the rebellion, whereas all kinds of lower orders, and even Lucifer himself in Caligastia, I think we don't tend to really value as clearly as we should the reality of the indwelling spirit of God as proof that God exists, and how powerful that was. For the mortal beings in the rebellion situation and making their choice for God. And I often wonder, you know, it's not a setup, but it's, I think, part of the challenge of being a Lenonendek son. You know, it's a lower levels where they're much like human beings, but they don't have the advantage of having the indwelling thought adjusters.
Right.
So that's... That's a big piece in the picture as well to me, as to why they went and why so many of the angels and the midwayers and the lower orders did go astray is because they didn't have the immediate proof in a sense of God being inside of them, that they were dependent on seeing outward manifestations, the finaliters and other higher beings, and that just wasn't enough for many of them, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, they're also have brilliant minds. They say that, you know, Caligastia has brilliant and original mind. So Lucifer, you know, that's how they're able to be so productive. It's because they're on the mind level, they're so brilliant. But the in the absence of the spirit to guide that brilliance, like you're saying, Pam, it can run amok. And when it runs amok, they self-deify.
That's
the pattern. Yeah. They self-deify, and that's, we also see that all the time. even
yeah, it reminds
now.
Me of some
it's
brilliant young people who tend to think they're way smarter than they really are. And the problem is they don't know what they don't know. And so, you know,
that's all down through history. You know, I mean, we see examples of human leaders who have, they lack any humility. They're self-exalted. They're full of pride, right? And they're the ones who wreak havoc, you know, who wreak havoc on society and civilization because they run amok with their own sense of power. There's no governing force of the spiritual.
They're so sure of themselves.
Of them. Yeah, and there's no humility. There's no humility, you know? I mean, you look at Jesus himself, and he said, you know, when people called him great, he said, why do you call me great? I'm just God's child, you know? What humility,
the Father's
you know?
Great. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Andre, you haven't said anything, and I know you want to say something. You must want. I mean, you know, I know that you feel strongly that about the Lucifer Rebellion, and you know, just love to hear your thoughts about that correlation, because it's clearly one of the things he attacked, and that foundational bestowal plan and the plan of progressive attainment.
Yeah, speak to it.
Yeah, well, isn't it always funny? You know, and some of those thoughts have already been stated already, but it's this idea of you spot it, you got it. You go ahead and you project onto others what your own biggest problems are. And so in attacking the progressive plan of mortal ascension, saying, what's this for? You know, what do? They just go up and they become, you know, debauched and deluded, and they come back and they have no better idea of the Father than anything else. It's all a big, you know, scheme and scam. No. Go pay attention to me, you know.
Right.
Don't pay attention to the man behind the curtain. Pay attention to me.
Right.
So, I mean, it really was pretty amazing. But here's what's interesting as well. We don't really understand fully as human beings the value of experience. Our experience, you know, we have seen, you know, in on Urantia, but particularly in the first, in what you could call the, you know, the developed world, where advertising over the last 100 years or so has become a high art form, the idea of persuading people to do things they don't really want to do, but are convinced that maybe they should do them because it would be good for them, whether it is or not. And, you know, a lot of us have been subjected to that, and having had the experience of going and hearing messages on the radio and seeing them on television and looking at things and having the opportunity to compare that with reality and not just take it in has been a very interesting kind of experience to go through, because I think that we on our planet are getting some of that experience of being exposed to all manner of deceit and learning how to navigate it, learning what's true, learning you know, how people are compromising with deceit as a way of sometimes manipulating the masses, sometimes trying to do the right thing, trying to do the right thing in the wrong way. I mean, there's so many combinations, so many gray areas. You know, you talk about 50 shades of gray. These are 50, you know, 50,000 shades of gray we have here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, part of the reason that they've put an archangel circuit here, not to get down that rabbit hole, but, you know, ultimately Urantia is going to be a remarkable laboratory for seeing all the things that people can be exposed to and why it is that with this mixture of traits, they should still go on to survive. And then having that as sort of almost a template for the rest of the local universe. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's some of what's going on here. But you know, think about all the things, all the ads that you look at and you say, well, that's never going to happen. You know, nobody believes that they're going to drink a particular beer and women are going to come knocking at their door. Although, subconsciously,
Andre,
I'm
devastated.
Yeah, I know, Marvin, I know.
All that beer I know. Drank, oh my God.
I know. You and me both, but here we are, disillusioned, yes. Disillusioned and having drank way too much beer, yeah. Yeah.
even to the level that we go on this planet, and we all face it. You know, we started out this conversation by Marvin telling us about his program this afternoon on outreach and evangelism, and why do we burn for people to know these truths? Because they really do set you free. And, you know, if you're willing to open your heart and your mind to what this book has to say, suddenly you understand that there's a purpose for your life. It's the plan of progression. That's the plan of progressive attainment. And that there's a way for you to do that, and that's inherent in the bestowal plan that's going to reveal these higher concepts to you and the most magnificent Father that could ever exist is the Father of all creation, and we're on a journey to find that perfection and be as perfect in our sphere as He is in His. And then along the way, there's these wonderful ministers who are completely devoted to getting us there. And we're all working together in that, we're all moving in that direction. And everything is supportive of that truth, that beauty, that goodness. And it's the purpose of every being's life, not just ours, being human. It's the purpose of the angel's life as well. It's the purpose of Lenana Dex and Veranda Dex and Melchizedek and, you know, all the way up, mighty seraphim are all serving that same great purpose of perfection, of attainment, of progress. It's so beautiful. And it is what gives you purpose.
And so just to underscore that a little bit with the irony of what has occurred on this world, and it comes down to a certain familiarity that you have. We have been taught not to trust those in power because of what we've seen happen, and sometimes rightfully so.
Yeah.
And so we have this anti-authoritarian edge, and frankly, unwillingness to trust right out of the gate.
Yeah.
But what we're willing to trust, somehow we get the idea that if somebody is a critical, ultra-individualistic voice, they must have seen something, or they might have seen something that we haven't seen. Sometimes that's the case.
Or know something we don't know. Yeah.
Right. But very often it's somebody that knows that pushing that button is a way to garner followers, to get people to question something that way. Now, and so, I mean, it's a confusing world. But here's the kicker with it. Lucifer lied to us deliberately and taught us really that lying was a way of life. I mean, that you could get by on deception. Not only that you could get by on deception, but the more subtle thing is you can get by on self-deception, on denial.
Mm.
The Father, this is the irony that strikes me now. The Universal Father never lies to us. His sons, okay, the higher sons never lie to us. Always about truth. They are always about giving us what is truly livable. and what is livable for everyone and what makes life better. But the irony is we're reticent to put all of our faith in that on this world because of all the times we've seen people fail. We're trying to get, and what the Urantia book is trying to do is to get us to a new tipping point, a positive tipping point, a point where we see more and more Jesus alive today on our world, in the lives of others, so that they can begin to trust and say, you know what, this faith thing really works. But we haven't gotten there. We're nowhere close. We don't see Jesus alive on our world today. And the Urantia book is advocating and saying, true faith will mean in greater and greater numbers and greater quality in each individual, we will eventually see Jesus alive in the lives of others. And at some point, there'll be a tipping point, and we will see people saying, you know, I can believe again, but the Father wants only good for me, that he's not bad daddy, he's good daddy.
You know, in keeping with...
I love that, Andre.
At the risk of, sort of tap-dancing on the edge of political realities, and I think we're all agreed we want to avoid that, but... It just in association with what you're saying, Andre, and sort of what's happening in our world, none of us can deny that a major theme of our current struggle in society, and it's not only going on in North America, it's going on in every society around the globe currently, is this question, and you raise it pointedly, Andre, what is true? What is real and what is fabrication and what is illusion and what is deception and what are lies? What's true and what are lies? And it just strikes me that theme being so prominent in our cultural struggle in these years, it just strikes me that it's just very symptomatic of the Lucifer Rebellion continuing to play out. And it feels to me like it's coming. I'm thinking of the 7 years where they all held forth and they all prevailed for these different points of view. And that at a certain point in time, everything had been said and everything could be done. And there was a reckoning and there was the playing out of a set of circumstances that put things back into some degree of right order. And I continue to have this feeling one way or another that we're headed there in our culture, you know, that this can't go on indefinitely. Massive questions of what's real, who's lying to us, who's telling the truth, you know? So it's really interesting the way it's playing out culturally. It is so reminiscent. And so it's so many echoes of the Lucifer Rebellion that I see in our culture. It's really interesting.
Speaking of trust, I think one of the most insidious of the deceptions, you know, that's sponsored by rebellion, going back to Lucifer, is making good people look bad. They're trying to convince everyone that a good person is a bad person. So you see how they did that with Jesus. You know, they accused him of blasphemy and idolatry and all these things and doing the wrong stuff on the wrong day of the week, or you name it. And that had, you know, and that they used those arguments even to support his being put to death, that he was this disturber of the people. He was a bad person. So we got to get him off out of our midst, right? And when he was actually the most supremely good person on the planet. So that kind of thing is another sort of telltale signature characteristic, I think, of rebellion is doing that, because it takes away the actual good people, because now you're suspicious of them. And so you have to be careful with that. You know, like if the media is all of a sudden beating up on someone telling her, oh, that's the worst person ever lived. We'll figure. Sometimes it's worth taking another look and see, maybe there's some other agenda behind the demonization projects, you know. So just a thought.
That's a good reason to be suspicious.
You see how that played out with Jesus.
I think of Shakespeare saying, "Methinks he doth protest too much."
Yeah, right.
You know, when someone's making such a strong argument, it's like, whoa, wait a minute. You know, why go that route? I saw a meme recently that, I saw a meme recently that said, and it just really struck me. It said, "Religious people." Often are religious because they're afraid of hell, but spiritual people are religious because they've been there.
That's pretty good.
You know, but in reality, we've all been there. We're living in it, in as close
we're
as we'll ever get.
It.
Yeah,
well,
to
and,
being
and
separated
you know,
from God.
You know, and ultimately, the lesson that the Arantia of the Revelators give us is that look. This is all going to come clear, and it's what they say basically over and over in different venues in different ways is by your fruits you shall know them. You know, Jesus said the way you'll know whether someone is deceptive or someone is spiritually true and spiritually grounded is ultimately the fruits of deception and
right.
the fruits of the Lucifer rebellion are bad seeds and bad fruit and rotting situations. You know. Mm. And so we're in an interesting period of time as to, and they say that the results of the Lucifer Rebellion sounded good initially and very quickly became chaos and upheaval and tragedy, you know. So it's like, you know, these things are all playing out in our world in many countries in different ways. And I frankly think that one of the great struggles of our current age is for high quality and spiritually grounded leadership of our nations. And I think until we get that lesson that we need spiritual leaders who are spiritually grounded and spiritually led in their wisdom assessments of all the different problems we face, we're just going to wander around and bump into walls real hard if we don't have leaders who are spiritually grounded. And so, I mean, that's a big part of our mission with the Revelation, I think, is to put that out there.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. I like that, Marvin, because what's occurring to me is that this very thing in this plan of bestowal and its various aspects of rehabilitation and this, that, and the other, and retrieving. We are called to be rehabilitators and retrievers ourselves.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I mean, this challenge is going through us, too. Mm-hmm. And like you say, our fruit will be the result of how much we're tuned into that pattern plan. So, yeah,
back to that point that the world needs to see Jesus living again. And what does that look like? And I have to think, you know, he wasn't political. I mean, he said over and over and over again, my kingdom is not of this world. And here's a great cross-reference. It just shows you kind of the attitude of Christ. And this is from paper 174-22. Tuesday morning when Jesus arrived in the temple court and began to teach, he had uttered but a few words when a group of the younger students from the academies who had been rehearsed for this purpose came forward and by their spokesman addressed Jesus. Master, we know you are a righteous teacher and we know that you proclaim the ways of truth and that you serve only God, for you fear no man, and that you are no respecter of persons. We are only students. And we would know the truth about a matter which troubles us. Our difficulty is this. Is it lawful for us to give tribute to Caesar? Shall we give or shall we not give? Jesus, perceiving their hypocrisy and craftiness, said to them, why do you thus come to tempt me? Show me the tribute money, and I will answer you. And when they handed him the denarius, he looked at it and said, whose image and superscription does this coin bear? And when they had answered him, Caesar's, Jesus said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and render to God the things that are God's. You know, it really is that simple. If we can learn to discern what the difference between what those things are. And when somebody is trying to usurp the things that are God's, we should say, whoa, wait a minute. That doesn't belong to you.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting about this? Can I just say something quickly about that teaching? People today, you know, there's a whole school of thought that Jesus didn't exist. I'm sure you've all run into this. Right.
Mm-hmm.
All the arguments they make for the belief that Jesus was a myth made up, particularly by the Romans, to get people to pay their taxes. And they use that teaching to bolster their argument.
Oh, my gosh.
So, anyway, how things can get
always
twisted.
Back to the coin.
Making a good person look bad. You know? Anyway, who knows?
Yeah. A lot of his teachings now are perceived as weak. And if you really went out and tried them, you know, you'd be perceived as weak too. But I think on some level, each person looks in their own heart, searches their own heart and says, yeah, I get it, you know. This can be perceived as weak, but I'd still rather be a loving person, and I'm not going to let this world jade me and make me into a suspicious, troubled human that can't believe in anything.
Remember how Jesus handled that? The apostles came running up to him and said, look, the Greeks think our religion is only for women and weaklings or something like that.
You know, it's interesting.
And that really got Jesus fired up. You know, remember, I talked seriously to them after that. And they were changed by it. The courage
going back,
actually involved.
Mm.
Anyway.
That's a good point, Chuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, going back, Paul, to your comment about render unto Caesar that which Caesar's and unto God that which is God's. That seems very clear. But it's also really interesting to put that in the context of all of what Jesus said in the Urmia lectures, where he went into much greater depth about the relationship between those two sets of loyalties, right? And he made the same point about, in an interesting way, very interesting way, he said that the resolution of the spiritual problem is to render all loyalty to God, you know, and when we all have God as our primary dedication and trying to understand God's leading and will, then the problem of who's superior among religions will fall to the wayside, you know. And then he made the same point about the political realm. He said, the resolution to your problems will really only come when you surrender national sovereignty to a higher order authority that is looking out for the welfare of all humankind. So it's interesting to look at that and say, and he intimated that there was a relationship between spiritual loyalties and political loyalties, that you need to have a spiritual influence, the idea that God is overarching, in order to have the kind of wisdom you need to move forward in the political and social realms as well. So it's... There's a complex relationship between the two sets of loyalties, I think. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the sovereignty issues that come up with that, I think, are also very interesting. Jesus talked about that. You know, the Father is sovereign. He's the sovereign, or Michael even. And any intermediate levels have to fall under this higher sovereignty if you're expecting any kind of political unity to come about.
There was something back in section 4 that I wanted to kind of focus on before we ended off that really struck me, and it's in the very first short paragraph, and it's a series of words they use. So the way they start that section off on the divine perfection plans And it's interesting. It's plans, plural, right? So it's, mm-hmm. anyways, all three of them. But what they say, the eternal son is an everlasting liaison with the father in the successful prosecution of the divine plan of progress, which is, of course, the first plan, but with the other two in support. And then they have a colon, which means they're defining what the divine plan mm-hmm. of progress is. And then there's this description, the universal plan for the, and there are four words, creation of will creatures, evolution of will creatures, ascension of will creatures, and perfection of will creatures. And I think those four words, because they're so definitional, they're so fundamental, really deserve some consideration. So the plan involves, first of all, making us in God's own image, with God, with the prerogatives of free will and consciousness and spiritual discernment. So we're created. That's the initial step in the plan. And then we get to evolve. Our nature gets to progress steadily and eternally. We get to evolve as beings, which is really interesting. And we do that in a context where we ascend through the cosmos and master the cosmos and encompass the cosmos progressively as we ascend and move through different parts of it. So there's creation, evolution, ascension, and then finally the perfection is the culminating description of this progression plan. And it's a fascinating series of nouns, really. Creation of us, mm-hmm. our evolution, our ascension, and our perfection. And that's just like, to me, that says it all. It says, okay, this is what they set out to do with us.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. and so it just feels very significant.
Yeah,
really
significant.
Indeed. Yeah,
I think that's one of the remarkable things about this section is it says so much.
Mm-hmm.
Like
so
all
foundational.
Of them, they're all remarkable.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This one
right.
is just
yeah.
like, it really yeah. spells it out. And
yeah.
it's one of those sections where, you know, okay, just from the title on down, the divine perfection plans, here you go. This is what they are.
And the way they, yeah, go ahead, sorry.
They're large and in charge and they're going to make this happen. And we can choose to go along with it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we can choose to be a part of it and help them achieve it or not. But I personally choose to help because I see the value of it.
Mm-hmm.
I see
Absolutely.
The beauty of it, the perfection of it. You know, it makes sense, which is what this revelation does. It makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just... We've had such a dark vision of what religion is and what God, and who God is, bad daddy is, Andre says, you know, and I have that, you know, why are we obsessed with that? Why, you know, we just lost Bishop Carlton Pearson, and last week I
yeah.
put out that interview that we had and me and Andre Traversa in 2008 with him. And
awesome.
Here he was, he had the courage to state one thing that is highly cherished among a lot of believers, Christians, and that is this concept of hell. And at this concept of hell is at the heart of it is bad daddy, right? And he had the courage. We talk about the courage it takes to be a good spiritual person. And to speak truth, which Jesus had in spades, obviously. He was truth, and it got him killed, you know. And Carlton lost his mm-hmm. mega church and a big majority of his followers in this mega church just because he said, so I've had a revelation from God that hell does not exist. And I'm not going to teach mm-hmm. that anymore.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it was very powerful. He
yeah.
came to these conclusions on his own. That's what's remarkable about it. He came to these conclusions being a devout man of God who, in the light of day, reasoned for himself, wait a minute, that's not true. And then he got that spiritual down grasp that affirmed that, that he had hit on something. He had had a, he had an auto revelation about it. It's not true. You're right. It's not true. Hallelujah. You figured it out. And he had the courage to say that to his congregation. And for that, he became controversial and a pariah to many.
Mm-hmm.
But he was willing to do that because his conviction was that strong.
Spiritual
and I say,
courage.
Yeah, kudos to him. I celebrate him from the moment I first heard that story in 08.
Yes.
I told Andre, we need to get him on the show because this man has done something of note in the, you know, in the realms of standing up to dogma and theology that's false.
Well, our understanding of the afterlife is so fuzzy at best without the original.
Yes, right.
It's not surprising that myths like that, whatever you want to call them, has lodged in people's minds because they don't have an alternative teaching.
Yeah. Which, that's a carryover from Zoroastrianism, too.
Oh, really?
You know, hell, hell and heaven.
Hell
well,
and fear.
Too. You know, fear serves an evolutionary purpose.
Yeah.
I think we talk about that somewhere, you know, even in the evolution of religion. But at some point, it reaches a point of diminishing returns.
Well, and it's a very low motivation
you don't get
for doing
the
right
stuff.
Thing.
You don't get to the good
stuff. Yes, it's low motivation, yes.
Yeah. You don't do the right thing just because you're afraid of punishment.
Right.
You don't do the right thing just
because
you
want.
Well, you
might, depending on where you're at in your
let's say
progress.
You shouldn't.
truth has to be lived out. Truth has to be lived out. You cannot you cannot live out an untruth.
And, you know,
well,
in that vein of how hard it is to stand up, you know, when you're in the thick of a traditional religion, and stand up for a truth that you have found in your own heart. I celebrate the emergent Christians, Pam, and I'm so thankful that you work with them and you love them and you serve them and you're right there with them, you know, encouraging, because what I learned from you and what I learned from being around them is that they do pay a heavy price for saying, well, wait a minute, does that make sense? And just asking the question, just having the conversation can get them drummed right out, you know. And along with that is drummed out of all of the resources, drummed out of the community, that the beloved community that you grew up in, drummed out of many, many things, hurtful, painful consequences for standing up for a conviction that is just, you know, heartfelt. I don't think I believe that. You know, I'm not willing to say, even if that's in the Bible, I'm not willing to say that's God's truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
that's a big
kudos
step.
To them. Yeah.
That's a big step. I wonder if we could take another look at the language in this section. And Marvin was pointing out some really interesting language. And there's another spot that just really struck me as we read it in the paragraph about the bestowal plan, where they talk about how the bestowal plan, the intention of that is to personalize and factualize, to incarnate and make real the love of the Father and the mercy of the Son. So, again, it's the service of discovering and revealing the Father. But I love the way they put that here, that the what the Creator Sons do, or the bestowal Sons, they, as we know, you know, they not only personalize, but factualize. Then they incarnate and make real. So
make
speaking
real.
Of the love of the, speaking of the love of the Father, they personalize it, they factualize it, and then they incarnate it and to make it real.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, wow, that really kind of wraps it up. I mean, it makes it much clearer to my understanding, at least.
Let me show you the fruits. That's kind of what that is.
Yeah.
Let me show you the fruits. It's not enough to just talk about them. Let me demonstrate them for you.
But to also personalize and factualize. I mean, if you think about it, you know, we can kind of have the same role. you know, talking about mm-hmm. how to share the truth about God.
Absolutely.
Is that we need to personalize it and factualize it and incarnate it and make it real.
Yeah.
So that's a pattern.
Reveal.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the other thing that's interesting about that, Chuck, I agree with you. I mean, I think that language is so seminal. You know, it's so foundational.
Uh-huh.
Personalized, factualized, incarnate, make real the love and the mercy. Love of the Father, the mercy of the Son. What's also really interesting is that when they go on to speak of this variation of the bestowal plan, when unfortunately, God's creatures, God's created beings, have actually moved people away from that goal, where they have forgotten or been misled or been led astray from the reality of the Father and the love of the Father and the mercy
right.
of the Son, which is what happened to us. And so what the Creator Son stand ready to do is to go into the extremity of those circumstances and engage in the same basic function that is described, but to do so in a real exigency, in real emergency circumstances. And part of what's interesting to me is with this revelation, we in our lives, in our generation, are really called to play a similar role. You know, we're called not only to make real and to incarnate in our own lives and make real and to share the love of the Father and the mercy of the Son, but we're called to do that in circumstances that are extreme and aberrant. And so in a certain sense, we are partners with our Creator Son in this very unusual manifestation of the bestowal plan. We get to work in partnership with Jesus and with our Father in these realms of rebellion, you know, out in the chaos of a culture that is misled by atheism and the Lucifer Rebellion premise. And so that's, we have an additional insight into that facet of the bestowal plan because of our experience and frankly, because of the unique association that we are in with this brand new revelation, we're playing a similar role to what the Creator Son played in going into a realm of rebellion in our world. So it's very personal. This is not theoretical for us. It's what we wake up to every day and what we deal with every day. You know?
That's
the need we see.
Heroic. They use the word heroic.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It is heroic too. That's why Jesus is our hero, without a doubt. And in all of this, I keep hearing him say, from one of my favorite sections, Instruction for Teachers and Believers, this is 159:3-8.
Yes.
He says, the world is filled with hungry souls who famish in the very presence of the bread of life. Men die searching for the very God who lives within them. Men seek for the treasures of the kingdom with yearning hearts and weary feet, when they are all within the immediate grasp of living faith. Faith is to relive in what sails are to a ship. It is an addition of power, not an added burden of life. There is but one struggle for those who enter the kingdom, and that is to fight the good fight of faith. The believer has only one battle, and that is against doubt, unbelief. And I think doubt is what, you know, trips us all up.
Yeah.
We have that one battle.
That's the seed that Lucifer sowed, is doubt.
Yeah, the seed of doubt. And we get tripped up by it, you know.
That's a great section, Paula.
Oh,
yep.
I love that.
I love that whole section.
Love it. Every word, you know, it's like, and I think it ends, that section ends by saying, oh, they so cherished hearing these words of his, and they recounted them for each other many, many times. And I can see why. Because, you know, that's us. We have that one battle. And it sounds to me like, you know, that's the battle for all of us universe ascenders, you know, for a long, long way. They're helping us find God. And we have to have faith. You know, we have to have faith. We'll get there. And I think the tricky part is the time it takes, you know. that impatience factor, that desire to take a shortcut, you know, to get there sooner rather than later. What does it matter how long it takes? You know, as long as we're pointed in the right direction.
You know, I have the opposite reaction. It's just like, I don't want to miss out on any little iota of the eternal journey. It's like the idea of rushing it up and making it happen faster is like, oh my gosh, look at what I would miss if I, you know, took shortcuts, you know. And so for me, it's like, you know, if you're walking this gorgeous pathway through a forest and you're heading towards the top of a mountain where the views are spectacular. So do I want to be transported immediately to the top of the mountain? No, I want to see every last little bit of beautiful forest on the way up, you know. It's like, you know, why shortcut anything? That's really ridiculous.
I think it's only when things get difficult, Marvin, that people crave a shortcut. But by your point, exactly.
Yeah.
We need to see it differently. It's not difficult. It's challenging, yes. But what are we learning from it?
Yeah, but you know, Paula, you know, we look back on the hardest parts of our lives in retrospect,
right,
and we say, oh my gosh, I learned so much and I grew so much in those difficult times.
It's
like, you know, that's an invaluable part of the journey.
A young family is a good example of that. You see a young family and they're really struggling to make ends meet, and it's so much chaos, you know. It's a joyful kind of chaos, but when you're in a house with a few children and they're all running around and they're all loud and they're boisterous, and you know, parents are trying to keep everything together and pick up after everything and do it, and it's hard, it's challenging. And yet most people would tell you if they could go back in time, they would go back to that time when their children were young. And, you know, as challenging and difficult as that is, you know, it's so rewarding. It's so beautiful. You tuck them in at night, they finally go to sleep, sit down, have a glass of wine, and reflect on everything they mean to you. And that's beautiful.
No, it's such a formative period.
Yeah.
And I think it's formative for the parents, too. You know, we kind of relive our own childhood through the childhood of our kids.
We learn
to
see again through their eyes.
That's the lesson of evolution and ascension toward perfection. I mean, we're going to be encountering those difficulties and those very growing kinds of circumstances all along the way, you know, through the mansion worlds and the constellation and the universe headquarters and the super universe and Havona, all the way to paradise and beyond. It's like the journey. You know, I have this little cartoon, I think I've shared it with some of you, of Panda and little Lizard, I think. I can't remember what it is, but it's like little pit of wisdom. And so Panda's riding along, and the Lizard is sitting on his back, and the Lizard says to Panda, you know, what's more important, the journey or the destination? And Panda responds, it's the company.
Oh, nice.
Love it.
So I love that. You know, it's all important. The evolution, the ascension, all of it is part of it. It's the journey. But the real treasure is us and our relationships all the way along.
Yep.
You know, that's what God is making, is that spiritual family of loving relationships. That's the treasure to me.
That's the fabric of the supreme. We're knitting it together as we go.
Yeah.
So
well, speaking of good company, they make an interesting remark here in paper 196. Well, in one place they talk about the teachings of Jesus constitute a religion of valor, courage, and heroism. So this idea, this heroic idea. And then a little bit later it's a different paper. This is 196. They say that they're talking about the human Jesus versus, you know, the deified Christ or whatever. And they say that it's, I'll just skip to the middle of this paragraph, 196:4. They say that Paul's Christianity made sure of the adoration of the divine Christ, but an almost wholly lost sight of the struggling and valiant human Jesus of Nazareth, who, by the valor of his personal religious faith and the heroism of his indwelling adjuster, ascended from the lowly levels of humanity to become one with divinity. So that struck me the first time I read that, the heroism of his adjuster. I don't know. It sort of says something about what our adjuster is trying to do with us, you know, in terms of good company, right? But we have this, yeah, but it's not only just sort of sitting there trying to get ideas into our minds or whatever. It's actually heroic, engaged in a heroic effort. And that Jesus' encouragement of heroism in terms of, you know, the messengers of the gospel or however we want to think of that, or even just in our daily lives, is consistent with that. So if we can muster up the courage, you know, they say his watchword was courage, and begin to, you know, step out in who knows what ways are appropriate for any of us, but that there's going to be a heroic partnership, collaboration going on from our adjuster. Mm-hmm. And that idea that our adjuster is heroic, it's so endearing in a way.
I love that. Yeah. It's a humble heroism. It's humility, heroic humility and humble heroism. You know, to so respect the prerogatives of will that, you know, and just so always be there to redirect and help and encourage. What a hero we all have within us. And, you know, he'll get us there if we just will cooperate even the least little bit, you know.
Sometimes that cooperation takes courage on our part.
It does.
Or
absolutely.
Even heroism.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah,
doubt.
It does. And what a wonderful,
doubt.
Well, again, friends, we're at the last 3 minutes, and I just love studying these sections with you. They're so amazing, and, you know, we have no problem mining them for meaning, I don't think.
No.
Which is great from our point of view, having spent so much time with these teachings. To be able to share deeper insights with each other and, you know, for the edification of our listening audience, we do appreciate you guys so much. And,
absolutely.
Yeah, our listeners
and
those who listen live and those who tune in later. And we love you. We miss you when we don't see you. It's okay. Go ahead, Pam.
Thank you. I'm just going to say no. It's just. I wanted to thank you for that diversion into the Lucifer picture because it really helps illuminate, you know, where we are and what we're dealing with. And then to wrap it up with, you know, the assistance we're getting and the beauty of the adjuster partnership and all of that. It's just, it's nice how we can start off in eternity and then come down into torment and then ascend back into eternity again. It's just, I love the circularity of it all. Thank you, all of you.
The idea of the mercy of angels, that they're ever present, their patience, their love, you know, just invaluable.
I think that's a reminder to join Marvin in 3 hours. He'll be presenting through the UAI webinar, and you can go to UAI's site, Urantia Association International site, and you can get the Zoom information there, I presume.
Under events. Yeah, just go under events under once events. You're on their site, urantia-association.org, and you can get it from there, from the events section.
Yeah, thanks, Andre. Yeah, I think we're going to have fun.
You bet. Break a leg.
Lively conversation.
You will have fun. It'll be a great conversation. And thanks for doing it, Marvin. And thanks to UAI for having it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and thank you, my friends, for another wonderful show.
Yeah.
We'll be back next week.
We're on for next week, right?
Yeah.
We're on for next week.
Yeah.
I am not.
Until then, bye for now.
All right.
Pam.
Okay. Love you guys.
Love you.
Okay.
Too.
All right.
Love
you too.
Love you all.
Bye for now, guys.
Be well.
All right.
Be well.
Bye. Have a great week. Mm. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.